This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Bush discovered who he was as an actor when he became a leading lady. He now writes and stars in gender-bending plays that are both tributes to and send-ups of Hollywood. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was the longest-running play in off-Broadway history. His Psycho Beach Party spoofed two Sally Field roles. He starred as a teenage girl who wants to be a surfer but suffers from multiple personality disorder. The Lady in Question was a melodrama set in the 40s. New York Times critic Frank Rich described Bush's performance as recalling Bankhead, Bacall, Stanwyck, Davis, and Russell, a walking anthology of feminine Hollywood legends. Rich asked, but what actor of either gender could top Mr. Bush? Now Bush is starring in a cabaret revue at the Ballroom in New York, where of course he gets to dress in glittery evening gowns. He says he didn't find himself as an actor until he put on lashes and heels. I wanted to know what dressing in drag brings out in him.
Well, what it initially brought out in me was a whole sense of freedom and expression that I didn't have. It was a rather liberating experience for me at first. I think things have sort of changed as I've kind of grown up, become maybe more comfortable with myself. But when I started out, I used to do a one-man show for years that I booked around the country called Charles Bush Alone with a Cast of Thousands. And at the time, I wasn't in drag. I would be just kind of in black pants and a shirt, and I played many different characters, and it would be kind of a narrative where I would have to play every character that, you know, I needed in that particular story. And so often there'd be male roles that just weren't really right for me, and I didn't think I was really very good at, and I thought I was rather stiff. And somehow the female characters seemed the more fun. You know, often women can just be, in our society, can be more flamboyant, more expressive at times. So I enjoyed that. And then when I started performing with my theater company in the East Village in the 80s, I decided just to put on, you know, this outrageous drag outfit. We really thought it was just going to be for a weekend. Little did I know it would be my career. But it was a very liberating experience, and I wasn't, for the first time, I wasn't thinking about, oh, what do I do with my hands? It just, somehow, it came very natural. The interesting thing I find now, though, thousands of performances later and thousands of pairs of eyelashes later, that what was so liberating is beginning to feel a little confining, and I'm actually ready to de-drag for a while, to be a fella, because it just, after all this time, I've been doing it since 84, sometimes it feels a little bit just confining to have my creativity always filtered through this sort of female persona.
What do you think the difference is between what you're doing on stage and what more traditional female impersonators have done? The female impersonators who specialize in Betty Davis and Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm.
Well, because they are doing specific people, and I do different characters that are sort of my own invention. Although sometimes I kind of
do a little Judy.
or if I'm doing, like, at one point in the show, I do this old movie sketch, and I kind of slip into a little Betty Davis at times just to kind of punctuate the line, or a little Susan Hayward. But it's basically my own character, I like to think.
But it also seems to me that you're more consciously gender-bending than a lot of your predecessors.
Yeah. But I sort of straddle the fence in many ways. It seems that you can sort of divide female impersonators into two groups. Generally, those who are comedians and are pretty, you know, kind of outrageous looking and somewhat maybe even grotesque, but are very funny. And then there are other female impersonators who go to great lengths to create this perfect illusion of beautiful femininity, and often they kind of lip sync to songs or, you know. But I'm sort of in the middle, because I'm a comedian, but I look kind of good in those gowns. My legs ain't bad, you know. So I think, you know, so I'm sort of in the middle. And I must say, too, I've lost any bit of integrity I may have had. Or I used to go to great pains where we would, when I would do shows, that I never wore falsies, that I wasn't really trying to convince the audience of an illusion. I was just kind of giving the notion of a general idea. But I don't know. Maybe it's just I've gotten older. But I'm so padded up. I think I've got two editions of the Sunday Times in each hip. You know, and you know, my God, you know, I go to great pains now to look very lovely. So you know, I'm very careful about the lighting. So I don't know what that is. Maybe it's just the more you do it, the more you kind of get into it.
You know, some drag queens object to feminism because it's not feminine enough, and really some drag queens really believe in traditional gender roles.
Yeah, I would think so. Isn't it interesting? And yet, I guess, you know, I was raised in a largely female household with two sisters that I'm very close to, and so the issues of feminism have always been rather real to me, and so I've always kind of prided myself that the female characters in my plays are sort of feminist role models. I always sort of played the career woman, you know, battling that devil man who's you can't trust him, you know. So I've kind of liked it, and I, you know, I have I seems like I have a female following. You know, I think there's, you know, always going to be somebody who's upset by something you do, and I'm sure, you know, some women might just find the whole notion of drag just offensive, and no matter what you do, you know, even if I did the Kate Millett story, they wouldn't like it, you know. But I, in my heart, I know that I respect women, and I love the kind of women that I admire, so are such strong women.
For our listeners who haven't seen your shows, let me ask you to say a couple of words about a couple of your shows.
Okay.
Let's start with Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
This was four big words. Strong words.
And, well, you know, not the of.
But we had, you know, a hard time, you know, when that show first started in 80, we started in 84, we moved it commercially in 85, and the New York Times wouldn't print the name in the ad.
Really?
And, yeah, and I wondered, I thought, you know, gee, it must be... I think if the play was called The Lesbian, they would have printed it. If it was called Vampires, or even if it was called Sodom, but you put them together and, oh boy, you know, head for the hills.
So tell us what it was about.
Well, it was kind of like a series of vaudeville sketches more than a play. And I played a lovely virgin sacrifice in ancient Sodom who is bit by the very glamorous succubus creature, this kind of Mae Westian... vampirus, and she, the virgin sacrifice, because of this bite, becomes a vampire too, and so the two of them are kind of in a race across time as they go through various centuries trying to steal each other's thunder, and kind of the joke of it was that they were both, after they left Sodom, they both were in show business, and so we saw them in Hollywood in the 20s where they were vamps and silent films, and then in Las Vegas today and they're still at it. So it was, you know, it was a cute show, and what I liked about it too is that underneath all the very silly campiness, it kind of, I thought it had a little something to say about relationships, and I think that many of us have friends or even, you know, relatives who could just drive us crazy and you'd like to murder at times, but if they weren't around, we'd certainly miss them.
Well, what was the very first time you dressed in drag?
Let's see. Well, I think when I was about 9, I think Bobby Fitzpatrick next door wanted us to put on his mother's evening gown. But other than that, it was many years later. I was in college and just dressing up for Halloween. But I learned really right away. It occurred to me that I got kind of bored when I just put on the dress and makeup and everything got all rigged up. Just as an end to itself, it just... I got kind of restless and sort of tired too. You just kind of want to spread your legs and, you know, and relax, you know. And I needed to have the role. For me, drag is so connected with the theater that I can't separate it. That as soon as I like for instance, we had a float in the gay parade this year, and I put together this outfit to I mixed and matched. And but this at this point, I certainly can. I've got probably more clothes than you have. I mean, I've a lot of dresses for every occasion, you know, if you need
I'm
anything.
Sure you have more heels than I do.
Yeah, well, call me, you know. And anyway, so I put together this outfit to wear, just to wear, you know, in this open car. And as soon as I put it on, though, my mind was just racing so quickly. I was suddenly Melina McCrory in Never on Sunday. 5 seconds later, no, I'm Audrey Hepburn in a 60s caper film. Oh no! And it was so dizzying that I finally was just getting like hyperventilating just because of the images in my head of the different roles that I could play in that costume. So it wasn't enough just to be, you know, don't I look swell in this lovely couture creation.
You know, it's really funny. I feel like I should ask you for tips about how to walk in high heels. I've never been able to wear heels.
Really? It's so simple.
Not that I'm dying to wear them or anything, but my feet ache and I figure it's not worth it. So you want to give me some tips?
Oh, I could run the decathlon in it. I could. You know, talk about drag racing. I mean, I could really. I walk better in heels, I think, than in flats somehow. I've fallen arches, kind of. I think the heels help me. But I must say, after a number of hours, it's agony. I had this part in the sequel to The Addams Family, which is coming out in November, and I play their cousin, the Countess Aphasia Addams Du Barry, and I was in high heels for 17 hours, on a movie set, and that was rather horrifying, you know. But for a couple hours, I don't know, you just sort of balance yourself and. I took to it like a duck to water. You know, I never quite understood when you see movies like Tootsie where the guys get in heels and they're wobbling all over the place. And I know, I guess it's for comic effect, but I never found it so tricky.
Actor and writer Charles Bush is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Bush. He's currently performing his drag cabaret act in New York. Did dressing in drag or doing theater in drag coincide at all with figuring out your sexual identity?
In a certain sense, it did. In just that, when I was in college, I was coming out gay, and I came out gay with a sledgehammer. I mean, I was just awful, just outrageous. My best friend and I, and we just it was sort of during the height of kind of the David Bowie sort of glitter rock period. We had red hair and eyeliner on, and I had just awful big. Fun fur, this big fur coat on. I thought I looked like Maria Schneider in Les Tango Paris, but don't know if everyone else shared that opinion. But anyway, at the same time, I'm taking these acting classes, and the roles that you would work on in class would be like Bo and Bus Stop or Biff and Death of the Salesman, and I just did not identify at all. And they're just so there are no roles to that or anything. You know, and particularly like in college, we would be in a. It was kind of a method, sort of, Stanislavski approach, where you're supposed to be using elements of your own, past and your emotions, and it was very hard for me to identify, and so consequently, there were like no roles that I even wanted to play, and I was really tormented because I was obsessed with acting, and all my life wanted to be an actor, and I thought, well, if there are no roles in the repertoire that I am desperate to play, what's the point, And I thought I could be the boy in Equus, but there are many other fellas who could play it a lot better or just as well, and I wanted to be special. I wanted to be unique, and I always wrote. And then I was always kind of improvising different characters for my friends. And I had a friend who said, well, this is who you are. This is what you should do. And it took me a while to really realize that was the case. And that what I really loved was writing the story and telling it myself.
Did you actually make it onto the stage in roles that you didn't identify with when you were trying to?
I didn't. I usually never got them. Uh-huh. I usually wasn't cast because they're, someone else who was more comfortable with it. I was uncomfortable with my masculinity. And in a way, I think now, after all these years doing drag, for some reason now I feel just more at ease with myself and ready to go from leading lady to juvenile. A leap, isn't it? A unique one. And also, I tell you the truth, there's so much drag around nowadays. I like to think that maybe I helped pave the way. Of course, was helped by Charles Ludlam and Harvey Firestein, and people went on before me. But I think the success of Vampire Lesbians, ran 5 years, and I think that certainly encouraged people to, think of camp and drag as being a commercial possibility.
Do you think it's easier for you? You said you're more comfortable with your masculinity now. I mean, you've been able to define what that is. It's not getting defined for you by the outside anymore.
I guess so. And for me, drag and assuming a female persona is not such a big deal. You know, I know there are great differences between the sexes, but in many ways there aren't. And at least for me, you know, I guess I have a slightly androgynous nature, and for me to go from male to female is sometimes just a question of how I cross my legs.
Can I quote something from the galleys of your forthcoming novel that mm-hmm. I've been reading? Mm-hmm. And the novel is called Whores of Lost Atlantis. It's a semi-autobiographical novel. And early on in the novel, the main character, who is very similar to you,
I should say so,
yes, says, on a cloudy day, I can't tell whether I'm adopting the mannerisms of an effeminate man or a hard-boiled lady.
Yeah, that's sort of it. Yeah, that book's very personal. It was an interesting thing. When I began writing it about 3 years ago, it was going to be a very superficial kind of anti-MAME sort of comedy book. And then the more I worked on it, and I realized that, you know, I was writing from the first person, and it was very much based on my experiences starting my theater company in the East Village in the 80s, I thought it was such a good opportunity for me to really explore, you know, my feelings about drag and androgyny and the creative process, and it was a very good experience for me, and so the book became much richer for it.
Well, let me ask you another question that comes out of the book, and I won't give away anything beyond this.
Oh, give it away if people will buy it. It just would kill me if, after all the work I did on this book, if it ended up in some little, you know, bin for $1.50, which I'm sure undoubtedly, ultimately it will. I won't go near the Strand bookstore for 2 years after that book comes out, because, you know, they always have things, you know, bargain books, even, you know, before they come out, but that would just kill me.
Yeah. Well, the main character who is, you know, starting his theater group finds himself having confusing sexual desires for the woman who does his wigs. And he says to himself, why did I have to feel heterosexual desires now, just as I was emerging as a gay cult star?
Well, that's slightly based on fact. Actually, everything in the book has a kind of its germ in truth and then exaggerated. And I'm very, very close with my wig stylist, as anyone should be. And we, I'm really stuttering here.
You're at a loss for words.
I'm at a loss for words. You really got me here. I'm usually asked much more superficial questions. You know, what size shoe do I wear? I don't think sexuality is so cut and dried. At least mine is. Mine sexuality is rather baroque, actually. And I've certainly enjoyed I can't even say the word. That word, heterosexual experiences too, but I wouldn't. I don't call myself bisexual, but I have. And anyway, and so I don't know where we're going from this. But
Your character says, you know, that he's.
But
worried.
It's confusing. So really, what I say in the book is sort of true. Is when I was involved with women, I would so torment myself with these odd questions of, like, you know, am I just using this woman somehow to be, you know, to allow myself to think of myself as sort of straight, or, you know, because I know I'm gay, and it was difficult for me just to allow myself just to enjoy the experience.
Well, I'm sure you were also
sham, you know, and then like in the book, I at one point I sort of just when I was in a heterosexual relationship very briefly, I sort of justified it by thinking that I really felt like a lesbian. and I had this girlfriend for a while in Chicago who wanted to be bisexual, and we would go to lesbian bars together so she could meet someone. But people thought I was a lesbian. It was very confusing.
It sounds confusing.
Yeah.
And your character is worried that he'd be branded a turncoat by his gay friends if they found out he was having a heterosexual relationship. Was this a concern for you?
Oh, it never went that far, frankly, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I exaggerate things in the book. But, you know, there is that notion in a way that I mean, often when I meet people who are gay, and a lot of them are getting married these days and having kids, and I think maybe such fear of the AIDS crisis, and I don't know why, but I just notice it a lot. And some very outrageously effeminate men I meet, you know, who I know, and they say, oh, I'll run into somebody on the street, and I haven't seen them in a long time, and they say, oh, my wife and I just had our first kid. I go, you're what? I find myself very, you know, I'm very judgmental, which I shouldn't be. But I sometimes wonder whether they're using these women in some way that's not really fair. I don't know.
Now, your father, I understand, listened to a lot of opera. And did he sell opera records?
No, my father, well, he had a record store, it's true. And I guess he did sell some opera records, although I think of him mostly having, rock and roll. But his store was in Yonkers, so it wasn't really an opera haven. But he wanted to be a singer. And so he performed with different sort of semi-professional and amateur opera companies in Westchester, where I was growing up. And so my bedtime stories were the plots of Verdi and Puccini operas, and sort of the first theater I saw were these productions that he would be in, where everything, including the chorus, were painted on the backdrop. And I just was enraptured by it. And I think that whole idea of sort of cheap theatricality stayed with me, and certainly you can see it in my plays.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the larger-than-life type of play.
Yeah, I love melodrama so much, and even as much as I love the comedy. And so my plays are often, sort of revenge dramas, and if you took away the element of parody or the shtick or the comedy, the stories themselves are stories of passion and revenge and good triumphing, and there's often somebody either jumps out a window or is being murdered. I think somebody's been murdered in just about every play I've written. It's kind of odd, and they're comedies, so I think that really shows that earliest interest was in melodrama.
So while your father was feeding you these stories of the great operas and thus nourishing your interest in melodrama.
I had a very romantic sensibility. That was, by the time I'd say I was seven, everything that I'm interested in today was set.
But I bet your father was not very encouraging of your interest in acting out the parts of great actresses.
Oh, yeah, no, pas nécessaire. No, my father's so stage struck.
Oh, really?
So stage struck that I really could have done anything, and he would have been approved. And I mean, just I think when he sees my name on a marquee, I think he can sort of blot out the first name and imagine it's his own. I mean, he kind of lives vicariously through me, and I don't mind it at all. So he lives in Florida now, but when he comes to see me in a show and, I bring him backstage and he walks out on the stage, I can see him just sort of inhaling it in. He just loves it. And so he's seen all my shows, and that doesn't bother him at all.
Charles Busch performs his Cabaret Revue at the Ballroom in New York until August 8th. Then he'll perform it for 2 weeks on Fire Island. His novel, Whores of Lost Atlantis, will be published in the fall by Hyperion. And you can see him in the forthcoming film, Adam's Family Values. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.